I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I have someone who you need to know. Her name is Ruth Everhart, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Ruth in just a moment. I want to say, before I dive into the depths of our conversation today, a big thank you to so many of you who I've recently heard from. To support the podcast, I've got to thank Melinda Schmidt, because when she was on with me a few weeks ago, she said, why don't you just ask people to help support the podcast on the podcast while you're talking to them? So I took her up on that and did that. And so if you in the past have not had your pen handy, I think I've only done it a couple of times, I'll go ahead and give you my address. And if you're interested in supporting the ongoing ministry of the Faith Conversations podcast, I'm here to tell you two things. One, you're welcome to do that, and I'm grateful for that. Number two, I'm not a 501c3, so it's not tax deductible. So just know that. If that influences not giving, so be it, but I want you to know that on the front end. And so the address, you can send any kind of gifts, just make it out to my name, Anita Lustria, and the mailing address is 905 South Ardmore Avenue, Ardmore Avenue, and the town name is Villa Park, two words, V as in Victor, Villa Park, Illinois, and the zip is 60181. Again, 60181. All right, enough of the housekeeping stuff. Let's get going. Well, I am here to confess something, and I'll confess it after I've introduced Ruth, okay? I think I saw a review of Ruth's book on a blog that I read, a friend's blog, not too long ago, and I thought, oh, I need to get that book. And the book's name is Ruined. Ruined. And it's by Ruth Everhart, and it's a memoir. And you're going to find out why the title Ruined in just a few moments. But the gist of the story is when Ruth was in her senior year at a small Midwestern college, two armed intruders broke into the house that she shared with roommates, and they held all five girls hostage, and they took turns raping them at gunpoint. So there you go. There is at least the beginning of the story, but it's not, well, I don't know. I started to say it's not the heart of the story, and I think that probably is a true statement, but it certainly is a deep piece of the story. So I want to welcome Ruth Everhart. She's a writer. She's a Presbyterian pastor, and currently she and her husband live and family live out east, Washington, D.C., and I am just grateful that she agreed to come and talk with me on Faith Conversations. So, Ruth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here with you.
Well, I am so happy to have you. Difficult, deep, heavy topic. And so, folks that have listened to the podcast for a while know this, that I used to host a live radio show, and I always had a co-host, and we would do the program together sometimes. Sometimes we would alternate days and do the broadcast alone. And in my live radio days, I came across a book that was not the same story, but it also involved rape. And I thought, I can't do this. And I asked my co-host to do the story. And when I saw your book, I thought, okay, I have no co-host to lean on this time. I have to talk with you about this story. And of course, the more I thought about it, I thought, me, fearful of talking about this story, this did not happen to me. And yet it's so difficult, I think, for women to talk about and to speak that word rape. Isn't that true, Ruth?
Oh, I think so. It was not spoken for years in my presence. And I feel like one of the things writing the memoir has done for me is help me reclaim that word as a powerful word, a descriptive word.
And a difficult word.
Yes, and a difficult word.
So, and certainly, I would even say, and a loaded word. A loaded word. It's interesting. I have been talking with my husband off and on as I've been reading portions of the book and getting ready to speak with you. And if I ever get up in the night and if there's an unlocked door, I mean, I don't go ballistic, but I lock it immediately. It's something that he just sort of you know, brushes by. And I said to him, as I'm reading your book, I said, you know, you don't understand. This is often a woman's worst fear, you know, is of someone breaking in and enduring sexual assault, of being raped. And he gets it in one sense, but I mean, he won't fully, because that's not his core fear. But I think that is probably, possibly a core fear of most women. As you've talked to women down through the years, is that what kind of bubbles to the top for many?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's interesting, and you probably have had this happen too, as people talk with you, I find myself stumbling over my words. It's so hard to talk. And I'm trying to determine where to begin. I mean, I gave that very brief thumbnail sketch of your story. And now this is years ago. You were a college student. Now you are a grown woman in a career. You're an ordained Presbyterian pastor. And, you know, you're living outside Washington, D.C., and I'm wondering the age of your own family at this point in time, your own children.
We have two daughters who are 29 and 26.
And when did you decide that you actually could write about this? And where in their years growing up under your roof, when did you decide to talk about this with them?
Well, that's a complex question, just in the sense that I started writing the book about 6 years ago. Hmm. It's a lengthy process, and the beginning to write was really quite a long time ago. And it was spurred in large part by my daughters, by having these young women in my house who were the age I was when my life fell apart. Mm. And I realized that I was having more difficulty being their mother than I had been when they were younger. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of curious to me, because there's a lot of parts of raising a family, you know, lots of different seasons in that. And then, you know, there's gifts and difficulties in any season. And on one hand, you would think that I was through the hard part by the time you get to be 20. Your kids are 20 and they're launching into young adulthood. But I found myself struggling and realizing that was when my life became so difficult, and that I just didn't have a blueprint for how to do that right, how to do that smoothly.
Sure. Well, and I'm thinking, tell me if this is the truth, I would all of a sudden start feeling overly protective of my daughters when they reached that age.
Yes. My younger daughter was in Boston in college, and a very urban environment. And that was scary for me to have her far away and to have her in this busy place. The other daughter had been in a smaller college in a small town in Pennsylvania. And that I noticed that felt more comfortable to me. But the truth is that you can run into danger anywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. You know, sometimes the things that we take comfort in are very elusive and false anyway.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. And I think at this point, I want to go back. We've outlined a few things. Folks know the basic story, but I want to go back, not to talk about specifically what happened. You recount that in your book, Ruined. But the emotional process moving forward from there, your life falling apart. And I think one of the things I want to say to anyone listening, that this conversation today is not expressly about sexual assault and recovering from that trauma. Honestly, these are transcendent themes. If you've experienced any kind of trauma or loss, what we're going to talk about today, there will be pieces of this conversation that you will definitely relate to. And so, you know, if you're thinking of kind of tuning out and going, oh, don't relate to this today, I would say think again, because I think this is a very important conversation for the reasons that you don't relate to it and for all the reasons that you do, both. So stay with us. And Ruth, I want to go back to, how do you pick up the pieces after such a traumatic experience? How do you not, you know, you were going to a small Christian university. You grew up in a Christian environment. You know, you had those faith, strong Christian faith underpinnings. What did this experience do to that faith?
Oh, it destroyed it. I mean, it just blew the foundations out from under me.
Yeah.
It made me question everything, and it made me realize how shallow my faith was, how really simplistic it was, that it was really not much more than what I would call the Santa Claus model.
Yeah.
I'd be a good girl, and you give me nice stuff.
Yep.
And I was very invested in being a good girl. Just by temperament, I like to think of myself as being somewhat agreeable. I'm the kind of person who avoids an argument, who avoids disharmony. I like to get along with people. I'm a middle child, and you know, that was my allotted role in life. And then I also had a real spiritual sensibility. I liked studying the Bible more than I would ever have admitted to anyone. I had to take Reformed doctrine classes in high school. I went to a Christian high school. I went to actually Christian schools all of my life. My parents were Christian school educators. So we were really saturated with theology and scripture. And I didn't really, I was the kind of person who didn't rebel against that.
Yeah. Yeah. I relate 100%. Pastor's kid and a lot of Christian education, and so I think it makes situations like this, I don't know if I'll say doubly difficult, but I mean, big time crisis of faith, especially I think when, I think those of us who maybe are a little bit more compliant accept our beliefs a lot more easily, and some of us even, I've said this on the podcast before, I feel like I was taught what to think, not how to think, and had to spend a lot of time kind of unraveling the what I was taught to think to see if it's really what I did think and did believe. You know, you were thrust into it maybe in a little bit different way in that this crisis launched you unwillingly, you know, in this new path of where everything became questioned. But I'm wondering about the compliant, the quiet, the peacemaker type, peacekeeper type maybe. Did you start expressing that to people around you, or was this just an inner dialogue for a long time?
A lot of it was very inner, except that I lost the ability to control my face, my reactions to people. I think that I turned very inward and was very just trying to kind of manage all the time. And so therefore, for people to reach out to me, they would have to do some effort. You know, they would have to push past that kind of wall that I built around myself that was protective. And very few people wanted to do that, I think. And then the other thing, the dynamic that was kind of strange about our situation was just the fact that these assailants raped me and my best friends. So you had not just that yourself was destroyed, but your friends were destroyed, you know, emotionally. And so your support system, therefore, is blown out from under you.
And yet each deals with it slightly differently, too.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, certainly one of my questions, and I'm about halfway through the book now, so I imagine you probably do deal with this in the book, but are you still in touch with these women that you were roommates with back at that time?
Well, we had lost touch after graduating from college. And when I got to midlife and I started wanting to revisit this story, one of the first things I did was be in touch with them. And at that point, it wasn't because I wanted to write anything. It was more me wanted to be a more whole person.
Sure.
I felt like I wanted to be a better mother. And I also felt like I was a pastor, I was preaching, and I was counseling people. And I would say things to them, and then I wondered if I was living it out. You know, like you would.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be inauthentic.
Sure.
I wanted to really walk my talk and live it. And so I just decided that I was going to have to kind of reinvestigate my life, like go back and open it back up again and say, how did this change my life? I mean, I always knew that it had changed my life, that to be a rape victim at age 20 had changed everything about my life. But exactly what, you know? I wanted to look at that.
Yeah.
And so I contacted my friends.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did? Okay. And I guess I want you to say more about that, but I also wanted to throw in this comment that really stood out to me, that a piece of the story also is what we are taught as women in the context of the Christian church, too, growing up especially. And especially, I would even say, more conservative evangelical circles. The things that we are taught that we take to heart that even spoke into your specific situation that just deeply grieved my heart as I read certain mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. And I won't get into that now, but messages that we take in as women or have been given as women along the way, especially in faith circles. But what happened when you tried to or did reconnect with those roommates? Were they willing, interested, or not so much?
Oh, they were happy to be back in touch. Mm. And these were difficult reconnections, though, in the sense that, you know, there's that initial fun, this is where you live, this is what you do. But, you know, you get past that after a short visit, and this thing that's, you know, the elephant in the room between you is this story. And to just talk about that. And we just cried and cried and cried.
Ah, okay.
You know.
And I'm wondering, too, you know, something that you talk about in the book, you know, this happened... There were five of you in the house the night of the assault, but only four of you were sexually assaulted. And I wondered if you reconnected with the other roommate that was not.
Yes, I did. In fact, she was one of the first. Ah. And that was almost happenstance that we reconnected, and which was part of what impelled me, I think. Because I had very... complicated feelings about her and her story, because sure. I mean, here we shared the same story on some level of this traumatic night, but the night was different. I mean, and it wasn't just that she had been raped, but it was how she interpreted that,
right.
Which was the way that Christian women are often, and not just women, but Christians in general are often taught to interpret things, that when things go well, it's a blessing from God. So if you are saved, if you are the one who is unharmed, is that special favor, you know? And that's a very complex theology. Well, it's not complex, it's simple, but yeah. it's difficult, you know, because there's a flip side to that.
Right.
And I do try to talk about that in the book, that if we say there, but for the grace of God go I, well, what if you are the one who had to go there?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are you outside then the grace of God?
Yeah, and I think you talk about it well, a difficult topic well, and I think one of the things that I want to say about what I've read so far is you are trying to help us move to a deeper place in our faith journey, because I think especially as Western Christians, I'll maybe throw that caveat in there, not all of us have experienced or had to go through deep waters. And I think sometimes we have attached that to our faith in Christ or our theology, and it has remained a very simple kind of theology, I guess, as you have worded it. So I think that in what you're saying, and I think in the way that you're showing us, you moved forward through the difficult but all that you had to grapple with, I think you're helping to show some of us a way forward into a deeper kind of faith journey.
Well, it's good to hear you say that, and I hope that's true for my readers, that reading this book, kind of being this companion to me on this journey, will in some way help them to maybe go to a place with me that would have been a little bit too scary to go alone.
Yes, I think you really do it well. I think you handle it well. It's beautifully written, by the way. You know, I think besides talking about just... you know, you're, well, I don't want to cut this part of it short. I want to go back. You first connected with this one former roommate that did not have the same experience. She was in the home, but did not have the same experience. Then you went on and connected with the others. And you were able to talk about it, cry and talk. And had the entire group been able to move to, I don't, what do you say, move, you don't ever move past, move through to a different space in their lives?
Well, I just want to clarify one thing is that one of the other victims I never did reconnect with.
Okay.
I just want to be clear about that. And there is a sense in which there was not a whole group of us ever sitting down and going, hey, how about that, you know? Mm-hmm. But I've been asked this question before, and I think people are curious about it because they want to know, can you survive something like this and go on and have a good life? You know, how do you, what did your life look like when you put the pieces back together?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what people want to know. I mean, the name of the book, Ruined, is named that for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, your own question, can, you know, and even believing that you couldn't, that life was, you were ruined, your life was ruined, and that you maybe couldn't move to this place. And so I think that that question is really important and an important one to answer. And I think a lot of people are want to know it because of their own circumstance.
And I mean for that title, that word, to kind of hang over the book almost like a question.
Yeah.
As you follow me through this decade, because I did believe I was ruined. And I did do things because of that belief that I would not have done had it not happened to me. Hmm. And I think that's actually just interesting to me as someone who loves literature and loves humans and the way God made humans. And, you know, I'm just not exempt from any of that human experience. And so it was actually kind of a puzzle to me, like, how did a good girl like me do some of the things I did? And is that then continuing the theme of being ruined, like, I'm ruined, so I'm going to get ruined more and more and more? And it, how do you get pulled out of that pit, you know?
Right.
And that's where this piece about the will of God seems to recur so much.
And I wondered, because, again, as I'm only halfway through, the theme is certainly has been stated in the first half about the will of God in an, very uncomfortable way. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you came back to that and talked more about that. I'd love for you to speak to that here in our conversation. The way some people view the will of God, and I'd like to know your view back then and your view today.
Yes, because I think those things all are shifting, and they're organic, and they're part of your response to your life. I mean, I've always said that theology is not something totally abstract. You know, it's a lived reality, and it matters. What you believe about God matters, and so, if you believe that you're lying on the floor tied up and someone with a gun is raping you and your friends because that's the will of God, well, you're either going to hate God,
right,
or you're going to decide that God doesn't exist and all of that belief system is malarkey.
Yeah.
Or you're going to have to reinvent your notion of who God is and what your relationship to God is. So I think that my word for that, my journey is really of increasing a sense of agency, you know, like finding my own will and saying, at what point does it connect with the will of God? And what can I do that I believe God wants me to do to move forward? For instance, the assailants were black men. They were African-American men who were masked. Now, I had very little prior experience with African-Americans because of the upbringing I had in this kind of Dutch reformed world, subculture. So I had tremendous problems then with managing running into black men. You know, just being in their presence would elevate my heartbeat and give me these fear responses, you know, of breathing fast,
sure,
and of sweating and of having a knot in my stomach, feeling, sure, like I was going to throw up or run. Well, you know, you live with that for a while and then you go, actually, this is turning me into this person I don't want to be. Mm. I think there's a name for this, and I think it's called being a racist. Mm. And, you know, that's not God's will for my life either. And so what do you do with that? And so, I mean, I took specific steps then to try to overcome these feelings that were not, like I say, not just an idea, Like, I'm not saying that I ever believed any idea about, oh, the difference between races. No, I'm talking about like a visceral lived experience that then had repercussions that I had to assimilate into my belief system.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I had this moment, which I describe in the book, of thinking Jesus does not want me to be like this. And being just kind of overwhelmed with going, oh my gosh, Jesus does not like this. And I just feeling like I was failing Jesus and failing myself. And, you know, like at this point, I was like 3 years out. And I just thought, I have to have new memories about Black men. I just kind of intuitively knew that's what I needed to do. So I sought out a church that had mixed races, and I joined a gospel choir and I sang gospel with Black men in the same choir. Mm. And that was incredibly redemptive to me.
Wow.
Because it overlaid new experiences and memories on top of the wounded ones.
That's beautiful because for many reasons, but not everyone will move down that path and seek a redemptive picture. And so I love that piece of your story as well. I haven't gotten to that in the book, but I love that. That will propel me to keep reading too, because I want to get to some of these other pieces of the story that I'm hearing you tell about today. And, you know, it's interesting because in large part, you know, we've certainly laid the foundation of what happened and what the book is about and your journey moving toward wholeness. But I would like to ask the question for someone listening who, in fact, has an experience similar to yours, or maybe has a friend or a child, a sibling who has lived this experience. And I would love for you to talk about how we interact with, how we can do a better job walking alongside of the victim of a sexual assault, because I think we're all thumbs. We don't know what to do. And then therefore we do, you know, put our foot in our mouth, say something that's absolutely the worst thing possible. And so I would love for you to speak to us along those lines too.
Well, I think that what rears up is the church's historic message about the role and worth of women and how that's tied into their sexual purity. So that if a woman now has become sexually impure, however you want to talk about that, and that's why I use the word ruined or damaged goods, that kind of thing. What happens is that really distorts your relationship to her. So I think the easiest way to cut through some of that crap,
thank you. Yes.
Is to get past all those notions of a woman's worth being related to her sexual parts and what she has or hasn't done with them or what people have done to them against her will. Mm-hmm. I mean, if someone, let's say someone has just experienced an attack, and I hope that's not the case, but the reality is that women experience attacks from men. And thank goodness it's getting a lot more attention than it used to be, all these campus rapes and so on. I mean, they're not happening more. I just think they're getting a little more attention and it's high time. So, okay, so let's say you know someone in that situation. You look at her, you're not thinking about her being sexually attacked. You think, what if she had been just hit by a drunk driver? Mm. What would I do? Well, I really wouldn't have to think about it a whole lot, would I? I would just take her to the hospital. I would get her medical care. I would take care of her physical needs without any kind of condemnation about it. No, like, subtext. Mm. No, oh my gosh, this broken bone, you know, this is something that will never be repaired. We have this attitude about sexual parts that somehow if they're irreparable, you know, and it's such a fallacy, and I address it really directly, by the way, in my epilogue.
Oh, yay.
Read the epilogue because that will be helpful for dealing with other people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so you attend to her physical needs, and then you make sure she eats well and she sleeps, and then you give her the space to recover, and you give her some space in which to tell her story if she's ready, when she's ready. And you don't ask her invasive questions like, well, what were you wearing anyway? You know, were you drinking? What were you, how much, you know, just check your judgment at the door. And I mean, if that's important to the story, you will hear it. And there will be time for all that because this is a journey. So you attend to the needs as they present themselves. You give her the space to recover. You don't expect her to recover in 2 weeks. She's not just knitting together a broken bone. She's knitting together a life and an understanding of who she is.
Yeah.
And she's furious. See, we also have to become more comfortable with women being furious.
Yes, I saw that almost immediately in the book, and really and appreciated that, because I think another thing we're taught often, overtly taught in the church, is to tamp down any emotions, to kind of be these emotionless beings. So, right?
Yep.
Yep. So certainly we're not going to be comfortable with fury, you know, anger of any kind. And I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. So I love that you also talked about that and addressed that. I saw that, you know, lived out in your story very much so.
Go ahead. The one final thing I would say about that too, finally, is to pursue justice.
Don't
assume that this has to be kept a secret.
Yeah.
That somehow she has to bear this burden as a secret. She was a victim, not a victimizer.
Mm-hmm.
And so why not pursue justice? And why not disclose what has happened to her?
Well,
I think the secrecy burden was very significant for me.
And I saw that in the writing, and you see it anywhere today. I mean, anytime something's brought into the light, it helps to at least to diminish the shame piece. You know, there are other things, but societally, because this is one of those crimes that we've just kind of kept in the dark for so long. And I think, as you said earlier in the conversation, you see that changing. I see more attention to this and much more talk about, you know, no, don't be silent. This shouldn't be kept a secret, etc. Because, you know, the more in the dark it is, I think just the heavier and deeper and thicker that shame piece is.
Absolutely.
I know you're hoping, and if I'm any indication, that your message in your book Ruined does resonate strongly with people, but how are you hoping that it will? You know, what are you hoping people will take away from the book?
In a word, hope.
Okay. Yep.
And maybe this is just my decades in pastoral ministry, but I've always known that if a preacher doesn't have hope, they have no reason to get in the pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that becoming a purveyor of hope has been really restorative to me. It kept me going when my own sense of hope would flag. And so, you know, because we all do sometimes get exhausted or despairing or whatever, but this is why we come back together in a body to worship or to be in a community of faith, is to have our hope restored. And so my book really is to try to reach out to people who will never sit in a pew in a church where I'm preaching, but I want my story to have a sense of saying to them, there is hope, you know, there is life after rape, you know, there is something more, and you can push back against the things that happen to you.
Let me close with this question, Ruth. You know, you talk, especially the first part of the book, as I'm reading it, I'm seeing your relationship with God just kind of crumble, and I know there was all kinds of rebuilding that transpires over the course of the book. What's your relationship with God like today? Obviously, we know you're a pastor and you're ordained in the Presbyterian Church. What's it like today? Maybe even because of what happened in the past or as a result of the transforming journey that you've been on.
Yes. The way I grew up as a Calvinist, we were taught that what you believed about God was everything, and that to be a good Christian meant to have your beliefs all lined up correctly and to believe the right doctrines.
Mm-hmm.
And doctrine was just supremely important. And so your goal as a believer was to understand things about God. And I think that what happened to me is I gave up that approach, which actually turns out to be a real gift.
Yeah.
Because if you go, actually, my goal is not to understand God. My goal is to be in relationship with this divine mystery who is entirely beyond me.
Yes.
You know, so I mean, I went through seminary and I wrestled with that on the page in the book, but it's not like I come to some perfect answer. And instead, I've really come to a place where I believe that God is a divine mystery. And so what that does then is that the person of Jesus Christ shifts for me, because now I have this kind of gut level sense that, okay, so there's this divine mystery and this God, this deity chooses to enter human time from eternity, to enter human flesh, and to be wrapped in this pain and suffering and the potential for pain and suffering, to lay on a cold, hard rock in birth and in death, to be in relationship to us, to redeem us. And to me, that it becomes much more powerful because I now have the appropriate sense of awe about that. So I'm just less interested in trying to get the doctrines to all make sense. And, you know, like, oh, the will of God is 97% and human will is 5%. And I mean, you know, which sometimes doctrines presented this way, you know, well, how do you manage free will versus the sovereignty of God? Well,
yeah, well, really, when you meet the person that you're passing on the street, they could care less. They want a God that meets them where they are and forget about whatever the percentages or any kind of, you know, theological pretzel making that we have to do, you know, turning ourselves inside out. Forget it. Mm-hmm. It's not relevant. I love that you talked about that, the God being this divine mystery. I think the view that you, where you are today, makes you a better pastor. I mean, I want to go to a church where someone like you is the pastor. So I love hearing that. And I think it probably helps give permission to someone who maybe, you know, is listening to the podcast that has grown up in a, you know, with a different view and just hasn't thought about this. And so I just want to encourage folks to pick up Ruined. It's Ruth Everhart's memoir, and it is a worthy read, and it will challenge you. And I know that you will be the better for it when you complete reading the book. Ruth, I am grateful that you're willing to speak about what happened to you many years ago and that faith journey that it launched you on. Thank you for sharing so deeply about yourself. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for reading it and engaging it and having me on the podcast to talk to others about it. I'm very grateful.
I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations.